This episode of Locked On MLB is brought to you by Built Bar. Built Bar is the best tasting protein bar ever. They're good for you. They're tasty, and I can't get enough of the mint brownie. Use promo code Locked On for $10 off at BuiltBar.com. Let's get on with the show.
You are Locked On MLB, your daily MLB podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, baseball fans, and welcome to Locked On MLB, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day. This is the daily podcast where we talk about all of Major League Baseball, and I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sully. Today's episode, which is being dropped on the 26th day of May, 2020, we're going to be turning back the clock and looking at 1990. Unbelievably, that was 30 years ago. It was a big year for baseball. It was a transformative year for baseball, not just in terms of the game on the field, but also how it was covered, how we consumed it, and the seeds that were planted for a tremendous decade of, well, turmoil and great memories. This show is available on the free and easy-to-use Himalaya podcasting app. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. When you staying at home during this strange time, you can tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On MLB, or check out some of the other great shows of the Locked On Podcast Network, where it's your team every day, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball with Scott Cullen. You can follow us on Twitter at LockedOnMLB_net. We're at Instagram at LockedOnMLB. I'm your pal Sully. I'm at Sully Baseball on Twitter, Sully Baseball Podcast on Instagram. 1990. You don't think about it as a really important transformative year in baseball, but in so many ways it was. It's a new decade, and yes, I call the first year where it's zero the first part of a new decade. I don't say it starts with one, okay? I'm not one of those people. A decade is 10-year span, and the decade of the 90s, in my humble opinion, began in 1990. It was a new decade, and it was also a new era. Now, it's funny, it's when you think about how memories are formed by the narrators that we follow the games by, the announcers. The 1990s began with so many things being turned on its head. First of all, CBS started to do the World Series and had been going back and forth between ABC and NBC for many years, and you got to have games that were called by Al Michaels, by Vin Scully, by Howard Cosell, by Bob Costas, by Joe Garagiola. It was a rotation between those two networks. CBS took over in 1990. They brought over Tim McCarver, who had done games with ABC. But now Jack Buck was going to be the voice of the World Series, and he was for 1990 and 1991. By the end of the decade, his son Joe Buck had taken over for Fox, and Joe has been the announcer for every single World Series since 2000. Which is strange, because I liked having a variety of announcers. Jack Buck announced 1990 and 91. Sean McDonough did 92 and 93. But a huge transformative change happened in how we consumed baseball in 1990. And that was ESPN started showing baseball. And suddenly, the idea of a game of the week, or just your local team, and then you follow TBS and WGN or whatever, that was thrown out the window. Now you got to have four games every week. Now, we take this for granted now. We watch stuff on our iPad, or we watch stuff on our phone. But to have four live broadcasts every week on ESPN, at least four, and to have break-in where, oh, we're going to this game, which is a no-hitter, this person has three home runs, it really changed not only how we expected to get our baseball, but also it made it easier to follow teams that were not just the local squad. Now, 1990 had the winds blowing for the scorched earth that would happen a few years later. Remember, owners were found guilty of collusion at the end of the 1980s, and they needed to sign free agents to expensive contracts to show that collusion was not still happening. And there was a lot of bad blood. Owners didn't want to pay the big contracts. Players didn't trust the owners, and for good reason. And there was another significant event that happened in the 1980s that spilled over and may have changed all of the events of the labor disputes of the early 1990s if it hadn't happened. That was the death of Bart Giamatti. He died in 1989, just a few days after suspending Pete Rose. Giamatti was respected, seemingly by both sides, and it looked like he had the best interests of the game at heart, but that heart gave out on him. But then again, this could be the martyr effect. You know, we tend to glorify the what-ifs of people when they die too soon. And as it was, Faye Vincent became the commissioner of baseball, going into the biggest battle the game had ever seen since the advent of free agency. The owners wanted a salary cap. The players didn't want any part of that, and they had reasons to fight. And Vincent was not the man to get both sides together. Now, I bet you forgot this. There was a lockout to start the 1990 season. And of course, it was portrayed in the media, as it always is, as greedy players want more money. Ignoring the big revenues, ignoring the windfall of the ESPN and the CBS deal, and of course, forgetting the fact that the owners were just found guilty of collusion. Now, fortunately for the season, the lockout didn't last long, and baseball resumed in April with a full 162-game schedule intact. Now, in terms of the play on the field, we tend to think about a season just about the postseason. Think about it. If you said 1990 and you're someone who likes baseball history, chances are you're going to be thinking about the Reds sweeping the A's and that taking place in October. And that tends to be the main thing that we associate a year with. But that entire year was just a wonderful year, strange and difficult to describe as we're watching it on new networks, watching it with new commentators, and experiencing baseball in ways that we take for granted now, but were truly revolutionary in 1990. And taking a look back at that wonderful season, just as a fan, and I was a fan, I'll get into my own personal memories later, it was really something that took your energy away. And tell you what, if you feel that energy going away, grab yourself a Built Bar. In fact, I'm going to grab one right now. Which one is this? This is great. They're brand new flavors, and I hadn't even talked about this in the last one. There are brand new flavors. You ready? I am currently holding in my hand coconut pecan pie Built Bars. That sounds like the most delicious Mad Lib you could have. They are fantastic. Got peanut butter banana, great. Pineapple upside down cake, you love that? There you go. Blueberry lemon's really good. And coconut pecan pie. It's right up there. My favorite is still chocolate raspberry. Not going to lie to you. But these are great. They're delicious. It's a protein bar. Tastes like a candy bar. Great flavors. Some have nuts. Some have not. Covered in chocolate. Soft. Easy to chew. They're delicious. And do you what? They're good for you. Low calorie. Low sugar. High protein. High fiber. This one's got 15 grams of protein. 110 calories. 4 grams of sugar. 5 net. Grams net carb. I got the word screwed up, and do you know what? I'm not even going to correct it because I don't want to break my enthusiasm for the Built Bar. So let me tell you something. This week, we have ourselves a special offer. We have our offer, which we've been doing, which is go to builtbar.com and use the promo code LOCKEDON. You'll get $10 off your first order. Use the promo code LOCKEDON for $10 off your first order at builtbar.com. But guess what? For this week, which ends on the 31st day of May, you get $5 off of every box of bars that could be used in addition to the $10 off with a promo code, which means you get 15 bucks off. And let me tell you something, it's worth it, if for no other reason than to have the coconut pecan pie. Go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON, get $10 off your first order, use this week's promo to get an additional $5 off. That's promo code LOCKEDON. BuiltBar.com. But do you know what? I've said it before. I've said it again. I'll continue saying it. We cannot live on Built Bars alone. Now, I'm recording this on Memorial Day, and we are going to order in ribs. That's right, ribs. And I'm talking about the good ribs, the type that would flip Fred Flintstone's car to the side, and we're getting the ribs from one of our favorite local places. How am I getting them? Postmates, baby. I don't even know what I'm supposed to say, baby. I'm going to say Postmates, baby. Because Postmates is the best way to get food delivered right to your home. Even in this time, they've created non-contact deliveries. So now, when I order my ribs, everything gets left right outside my door. And they have Postmates Pickup, which have been used to take takeout from some other restaurants if I want me some fish and chips too. But it's not just ribs. It's not just your fish and chips. They've made my life easier by picking up anything I need from Walgreens and 7-Eleven and dropping it off outside my door. Just download Postmates on iOS or Android, find your favorites, and get anything you want delivered within the hour. And look, for a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. Start your free deliveries, download the app, and use the code LOCKEDON. One word, that's Locked On, LOCKEDON, Locked On. You know how to spell Locked On. It's right there in this podcast description. Smash them into one word, $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. Lots of great memories and lots of great moments in 1990. Now, remember, the Reds and the Pirates were two of the best teams of the 1970s. They each won two World Series titles in the 70s and appeared in a bunch of other postseason series. But after they faced off in the 79 postseason, they didn't make it back to the playoffs for the entire 1980s. They turned the page, and suddenly the Pirates and the Reds were back in the postseason. The Reds won the division wire to wire, and the Pirates beat the Mets, which were really kind of the end of their run. Now, the A's were the defending champs. But the title that they won in 1989 was a muted celebration. I could tell you that for personally, because I was in the Bay Area in 1989. And even though the A's won the World Series, all the attention was on the aftermath of the earthquake that took place just before Game 3. The A's were inevitably going to win the World Series in 1990, so there was an anticipation for back-to-back titles, and this one was going to be a wild celebration. Now, here's something that I kind of forgot about until I started doing a little bit of homework for today's podcast. 1990 was the year of the no-hitter, and it was kind of wild, not only how frequently it occurred in 1990, but how infrequently it had happened in the previous 3 years. Between 1987, 88, and 89, combined those three seasons, there was a total of two no-hitters. Juan Yepes of the Brewers did one in 87. Tom Browning of the Reds did one in 88. Nobody threw one in 1989. In 1990, it seemed like everybody threw one. Mark Langston and Mike Witt combined for a no-hitter in Langston's first start with the Angels. When the dust settled, there were seven no-hitters thrown in the season. Dave Stewart and Fernando Valenzuela each threw one on the same night. Nolan Ryan added to his record total. Randy Johnson threw his first no-hitter. Terry Mulholland stunned his former Giants teammates. And after several attempts where he lost the no-hitter in the ninth, Dave Steeb finally nailed down a no-hitter in September. Brian Holman, who was the other pitcher in the Mark Langston-Randy Johnson trade from the year before, got to within one out of a perfect game against the A's when Ken Phelps homered. Now, I had to see if Ken Phelps homered over Jay Buhner's head. Jay Buhner was not the right fielder, but I had to look that up in honor of Jerry Stiller. Rest in peace. Andy Hawkins, by the way, of the Yankees, did not allow a hit on his July 1st start, but he got the loss as the White Sox scored four unearned runs. He lost his no-hitter. Now, another thing is, when you have a season where all you remember are the division winners and the champions, you forget the fact that sometimes you get a memorable, unexpected season from a team that gave their fans a thrill. I just mentioned the White Sox, who beat the Yankees in the game where Andy Hawkins did not allow a hit. Well, that was a really memorable year for the White Sox. It's not one I bet you think about as memorable years. It was the last year they had the curse of C on their hat. It was also their last year in Comiskey Park. But they won 94 games that year. That was more than the Red Sox won. The Red Sox were the division champs in the East, but there was no Central back then. The White Sox would have easily won a Central division had it existed. It was also the final year of Old Comiskey Park. Jeff Torborg won Manager of the Year. Bobby Thigpen saved an unheard of 57 games. And the team did a turn-back-the-clock uniform night. Now that's commonplace. But the 1990 White Sox were the team that innovated that. So when you think of 1990, I'm guaranteeing you're not saying, oh yeah, that was a great year for the White Sox. But you know what? It kind of was. It was also the first year that Barry Bonds really broke out, and he won his first of many Most Valuable Player awards. Ricky Henderson got his lone MVP awards. Two of the greatest offensive players in history had their crowning season. And it was the seeds of the success that you saw from the Indians and the Yankees later in the decade were planted. Both the Indians and Yankees were terrible. But the Indians had Joey Bell, who would later go as Albert Bell. And they also pulled off the Joe Carter trade. They traded Joe Carter to San Diego, and they got back, amongst a few other players, Sandy Alomar Jr. and Carlos Baerga, who were key building blocks for what would eventually become the great Indians run that got within so close of winning a World Series title. Lest we forget, the Yankees were one of the worst teams in baseball that year, and it was easy to get a ticket at Yankee Stadium. On the active roster, it was a bunch of people who I bet you forgot ever played for the Yankees, except for one, Jim Leyritz. Jim Leyritz was on that 1990 Yankee team and would eventually go on to win two World Series titles when the Yankees put everything together. In September, Ken Griffey Sr. was the last link to the big red machine, but for whatever reason was let go by the Reds as they were making their run for what would eventually be a World Series title. And there could have been some bad blood. That could have been a really kind of nasty feel-bad story, but eventually it turned into one of the great feel-good stories in baseball history as the Seattle Mariners picked him up, and Ken Griffey Sr. and Ken Griffey Jr. played in the same lineup. And on a wonderful night in Anaheim in September of 1990, Ken Griffey Sr. and Ken Griffey Jr. hit back-to-back homers. Cecil Fielder that year hit 51 home runs, and that meant he was the first one to hit 50 since George Foster in 1977. Think about that for a second. Not one single player hit 50 home runs in the 1980s. Not one. Cecil Fielder came back from Japan, came to Detroit, hit 51 home runs. By the end of the decade, 50 home runs would be kind of mundane. And it was also, when you look back, people looked at stats differently and people looked at value of players differently. Bob Welch won the Cy Young Award because he had 27 wins. But you can make a strong argument, he wasn't even the best pitcher on his own team. Dave Stewart was the number one pitcher on that team. And Roger Clemens had a better year than arguably both of them. But they gave the Cy Young Award to Bob Welch. That was the end of the line for Davey Johnson as manager of the Mets, Whitey Herzog as manager of the Cardinals. It's funny, Joe Torre took over the Cardinals in 1990. And at the time, they're recycling Joe Torre. Poor schmuck, he's never going to win anything, is he? He's in the Hall of Fame now. That was also the year Bobby Cox took over the Braves. It was an important year. It was a transition year. A lot of players who were stars in the 80s were fading out, and a new crop of stars were staking their claim to be the superstars of the 90s. I mentioned Griffey and Bonds and the foundations of some great teams, including the Braves, including the Yankees, including the Indians, were all being felt. But you also saw the first full year of Faye Vincent's truly ineffective commissionership, which eventually led to his ouster and the rise of Bud Selig. You saw the lockout, which if they had come up with some sort of long-term agreement at that point, we may have prevented a strike in 1994. Of course, all that could have been different if Giamatti had been alive. But it was also when we started consuming baseball differently in ways which now we say, yeah, isn't that how you do it? But in 1990, we all perked up and said, whoa, look at all the baseball we can consume. Now, in tomorrow's podcast, I have some personal memories of 1990, as I went coast to coast, not just in terms of my love of watching baseball, but where I lived, and the wonderful freedom and sensation of just going to a game whenever I felt like. But that's a tease for tomorrow's podcast. For now, you can go to the free and easy-to-use Himalaya podcasting app. You can like us on all the different places like Twitter and Instagram. And please follow some of the other great shows on the Locked On Podcast Network, including Locked On Fantasy Baseball with Scott Cullen. Going over why 1990 was such a landmark year, this is the Locked On MLB Podcast for the 26th day of May, 2020. I'm your host, Paul Francis Sullivan. Please call me Sullivan.